professor of international relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. His most recent book is titled The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. He recently wrote an article for Truthout headlined, Washington is obstructing the path to a political settlement in Ukraine. And his recent Le Monde piece is headlined, A Cold War by Any Other Name. There's been much debate over the definition of the term Cold War, but one thing's for sure, we're in one now. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Ashkar. If you can start off with that issue that's on the table right now, this 12-point Chinese peace plan, talk about how the U.S. media and the U.S. government characterized it. Talk about what you feel is being missed.
Yes. Well, first of all, good morning, Amy, and thank you to you and to Nermeen for inviting me. It's very important to get this opportunity, especially for a book like this one, which is of the kind that the mainstream prefers to ignore, as you know well. Now, about the Chinese plan, well, that is part of an attitude that has been expressed by China, actually since the beginning of the Russian invasion in February last year. From the very beginning, I mean, 2 days into the invasion, China stated that it stands for the territorial integrity of all countries, including Ukraine. That was specified in this way. And yet that was completely ignored and shunned by Washington. And the same story happens now, because this plan is an attempt by China to set principles, general principles, and they include territorial integrity and sovereignty of all countries. So that's a very important principle to start with in addressing the issue of Ukraine. And yet that has been shunned and denounced as a sham, as empty, and all that. So there is deliberately no will on the side of Washington to get China into that, and yet there can't be any political settlement of this without involving China, and I would say also without involving the United Nations, where China, of course, is one of the five permanent members of the Security Council.
You say even Zelensky acknowledged what China was putting forward, and that while the United States says this is clearly a pro-Russia plan, that even Putin bristled at this point of China acknowledging the sovereignty of Ukraine.
Right. I mean, there was an amazing contrast between U.S. President Joe Biden speaking of the Chinese plan in very contemptuous terms, and the Ukrainian president himself, who actually emphasized the fact that this is a positive and a good starting point. And there have been, therefore, since this plan, increased negotiations and discussions between the Ukraine government and the Chinese government. So, again, this is a matter of attitudes, and I think that it is very deliberate on the side of Washington. That's part of what I call the new Cold War, which hasn't started now. This deliberate desire to keep China out, to keep the United States in control of everything. I mean, this is really, and it doesn't take Beijing or Moscow to acknowledge or to see it. I mean, there is indeed, a very clear U.S. Hegemonic position, and that has been the case since the 90s.
So, Gilbert Ashkar, if you could, let's go to your book and the title, The New Cold War. If you could explain what the features of the war are, who you think the principal adversaries are, and why you believe that this situation is more comparable to the global configurations of power prior to World War I, rather than that which existed between 1945 and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, which is, of course, what was termed the Cold War.
Right. Well, actually, the expression Cold War existed before the First World War. And the first use, I mean, on the record of that expression is by the German socialist leader, Edward Bernstein. And by that expression, he meant the fact that Germany was engaged in a military buildup in preparation of war against the France and the rest of its European rivals, without yet getting into a real war, into a hot war. And that's what he called a Cold War. That's the origin, actually, or the first use of the expression. And the particularity of the Cold War of post 1945, the one that is considered by historians to run from 1945 after the Second World War until 1990-91, that Cold War had also an ideological dimension. But the ideological dimension is not what is called the Cold War. The Cold War refers to the military buildup and the fact that the United States, in particular, for the first time in its history, kept, even without war, a high level of military expenditure, a very high level of military expenditure, much higher than what you had between the two world wars, let alone what existed before the First World War. And that's what some American economists call the permanent war economy. Right, and that is a key characteristic of the Cold War, whether the 1945-1991 or the new Cold War that actually started after the demise of the Soviet Union, started first by Washington. Washington maintained a military budget based on the scenario of two major wars, and that was clearly, I explained that at the time in articles, two articles which are reproduced in the book. They make two chapters out of five, in which I said in the 90s, I showed how the military planning of the Pentagon was based on the possibility of war with both Russia and China. And that was there. And this, I mean, will lead on the background of other provocative attitudes by Washington towards these two countries into the new, what I call the new Cold War, which I identified as starting with the Kosovo War, due to the fact that this was the first time NATO as such enters into a war and a war circumventing the United Nations Security Council.
And Gilbert Rachkar, so if you could speak about that, what the involvement of NATO was in Kosovo, because the first, in fact, airstrikes that NATO carried out in its history were in Bosnia, against Bosnian Serbs, to prevent the ethnic cleansing of Bosnian Muslims that was underway then. What distinguished the two air wars from Kosovo from those in Bosnia?
Right. I mean, the bombings since the early 90s, the bombings in former Yugoslavia remained relatively limited and were linked to the United Nations intervention in that area. But the Kosovo War is the first real war. I mean, that's what you can call a war for NATO. I mean, of course, you had a war in Bosnia, you had a war in former Yugoslavia, but NATO, the first real NATO war is the Kosovo War, and that war was conducted by circumventing the opposition of both Moscow and Beijing at the UN Security Council. So that set a pattern of ignoring, if you want, the international law and the United Nations that the two other countries found extremely alarming. And of course, that will be repeated at a much higher scale later on with the invasion of Iraq in 2003, which again was completely illegal by the standards of international law, and again, of course, circumvented the Security Council.
Professor Rachkar, in an article published earlier this year headlined Consistent Anti-Imperialism and the Ukraine War. You wrote, quote, consistent anti-imperialists must combine their support of Ukraine's right to self-defense with support for a UN-based peaceful settlement on the ongoing war. Those who call for peace while opposing Ukraine's right to get what it needs for its defense are, in fact, advocating its capitulation. Can you talk about this, Ben? Also, talk about the increasing role of China here and also in other places, and how the U.S. is continually trying to counter that, and the significance of Blinken going to China this weekend.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, there are two pitfalls that progressive forces should be avoiding. One is to react to Washington and NATO's support to Ukraine by rejecting this and ignoring in this way the agency, if you want, of the Ukrainians who are fighting for their country, they are fighting for their population, and we can see Russia is targeting more and more the civilians in Ukraine. Ukraine has the very legitimate right to self-defense, and therefore, if we acknowledge this right to self-defense, we have to acknowledge its right to get weapons for this self-defense. But this being said, I would put the emphasis on self-defense. That is, I think it is right that Ukraine gets weapons for defensive weapons like anti-aircraft, anti-missile, anti-tank, and the rest. But the demands that of escalation of the war, of enabling Ukraine to strike deep into Russian territory and the rest, these are extremely dangerous. They put the world at very high risk. And I would say they put also the Ukrainian population at very high risk, because Russia has not yet done to Ukraine what it could do if it wanted to turn even more violent than what it is. Now, on the other hand, as progressive, we have to be in favor of a peaceful settlement, a political settlement, but on the basis of principles. And I think there can't be any sustainable peace for Ukraine without the involvement of the United Nations. And without basing that peace on the principles of the UN Charter, including, of course, the sovereignty and integrity, the territorial integrity of all countries. And that would mean also, therefore, involving China. And China is obviously the country with the highest leverage over Russia, even much more now, because Russia has, because of that war, turned more and more dependent in some way economically and the rest on China. So it is imperative to associate China, to work with China, and in order to get to some peace. And, you know, even European countries like France, like Germany, major allies of the United States, advocate the involvement of China in a political settlement process, whereas Washington until now has been blocking this, probably also waiting to see what the counteroffensive, the ongoing Ukrainian counteroffensive, might produce. Now, you mentioned in the news that Antony Blinken is going to Beijing for the first time since 2018. Imagine that. That's amazing. I hope then that that Washington will change its attitude and try to work with China for a political settlement of this terrible tragedy.
Gilbert Achecard, before we conclude, I'd like you to explain the longer view, historical context of what you think propelled the Russian invasion of Ukraine at this moment. You speak about the neoliberal policies, for example, that were implemented immediately after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and how that may have contributed to the rise of Putin himself, and the distinction between the causes of the Russian invasion in 2014 and 2022, why you see those as distinct?
Right. Putin himself, and I would say even Xi Jinping for China, they are in part the product of the kind of international conditions that have been created by Washington. I mean, Washington in the 90s had a window of opportunity during which, as it acknowledged itself, it was in a position to shape the world. And therefore, it faced several options. And, well, instead of going for options, peaceful options, options leading to a long-term peace in international relations and into enhancing the role of the United Nations, it made the opposite choices. One of them being, of course, the choice of not only keeping NATO, which was originally built as a defensive alliance against the Soviet Union, but to enlarge NATO eastward towards countries that were previously under Soviet domination. You mentioned, yes, the neoliberal policies that were promoted and fostered in Russia by Washington, by the International Monetary Fund and the whole set of Western interests. And they were absolutely destructive of Russian society. I mean, the 90s are nightmarish if you look at what happened, at the very sharp drop in the standard of living of the Russians, to the point that in the late 90s, the gross domestic product, that is the whole economy of Russia, was equal to only the military budget of the United States. That tells you a lot, right? So this is the creation that created the condition, the situation that created Vladimir Putin. I mean, his kind of nationalist authoritarian rule. And of course, even that rule itself has an evolution over the years, which went further and further into nationalism and authoritarianism. But that was on a background of conflicting relations with Washington, with the Western countries, with NATO, and played a real role in that regard. And in the same way, as I just said, that also the kind of provocative attitude of the United States towards China created conditions under which nationalism can flourish and lead also to a increased authoritarianism and nationalism as represented by China's present ruler, Xi Jinping. So there is a connection between all that, because the global conditions create a terrain for this or that, depending on their nature, this or that development. So, yes, you had this. Now,
we just have a minute
wars,
to go, I mean, Professor Ashkar.
Excuse me?
We just have a minute to go, Professor Ashkar.
Oh, right. Well, very quickly, the two wars, the two military interventions by Russia in Georgia in 2008 and in Ukraine 2014 were meant by the Russian side to block the accession of these two countries to NATO by creating a war-like situation with the two countries. We can't say the same of the annexation of Crimea, which also took place in 2014. Which was meant by Vladimir Putin as a means to restore his popularity, which had been dwindling beforehand. He knew how this could play very well with Russian nationalism. And the 2022 invasion, indeed, is plainly in that context. It wasn't to block Ukraine's accession to NATO, because that wasn't on the table anyway. At that point.
Joubert Ashkar, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Professor of International Relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. His most recent book, just out, The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. And we'll link to your most recent piece, Washington's Obstructing the Path to a Political Settlement in Ukraine. Coming up, we go to Johannesburg, South Africa. Why was Kumi Naidoo, the former head of Amnesty International, as well as Greenpeace, thrown out of a bank meeting? Stay with us.
want to be heroes, number practically zero. But there are millions who want to be civilians. Soldiers who want to be heroes, number practically zero. But there are millions who want to be civilians. Come and take my eldest son, show him how to shoot a gun. Wipe his eyes if he starts to cry when the bullets fly. Give him a rifle, take his hoe, show him a field where he can go.
Soldiers Who Want to Be Heroes by The Specials. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We end today's show in South Africa, where climate campaigners attempt to disrupt the annual shareholders' meeting for Standard Bank to protest the bank's financing of the proposed East African crude oil pipeline, known as ECOP. The 900-mile pipeline would carry crude oil from Uganda to Tanzania. France's Total Energies and the China National Offshore Oil Corporation are behind ECOP, working with Ugandan and Tanzanian state-owned oil firms. Kumi Naidu, former head of Greenpeace and Amnesty International, and Extinction Rebellion activist Malik Dassou were forcibly removed from Standard Bank during their peaceful protest. Kumi Naidu joins us now from Johannesburg, South Africa. Kumi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain your protest and explain exactly for a global audience what ECOP is.
So basically, Standard Bank, like many other banks around the world, on the one hand, now recognize that we are in a climate emergency, recognize that there must change, but their actions appear to be contradictory when it comes to an increase in fossil fuel investments that we are seeing, as was the case with Standard Bank. In particular, the East African crude oil pipeline project will see about 100,000 Tanzanians and Ugandans displaced. We've already seen the signs of human rights violations. Of course, as always, they will promise that there's going to be massive numbers of jobs. We know most of the jobs are transient. Most of the early jobs, in fact, at the higher paid level will be people from outside of community. The bottom line, though, is that this East African crude oil pipeline is a carbon bomb. The amount of carbon that this would put into the atmosphere will be catastrophic, right? That would be the equivalent of sort of 9 million cars, for example, on the road. And so in addition to that, Standard Bank is also supporting the Cabo Delgado gas projects in Mozambique. And here in South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal, they have been supporting Tendele Coal, a project that has seen activists being killed and so on. And essentially what we are saying to Standard Bank and to other banks, that you need to recognize that you are now legitimate targets of protests, that we do not have time right now to go after every oil, coal, gas company, every deforestation company and so on. We have to follow the money and shut the flow of capital at source. And basically this might have been aimed specifically at Standard Bank, but it is also a call and encouragement to activists all over the world. Let's follow the money and let's shut the flow of capital to dirty energy and start redirecting it to clean energy.
And Kumi Naidu, so could you explain what are the companies that are backing this pipeline, the Chinese corporation, the National Offshore Oil Corporation, as well as Total Energies, the French company?
Well, Total is the biggest play in all of this. And here's the kicker, right? Assuming that this was okay in environmental terms, right? Let's just for a moment say all our concerns are misplaced, right? But all of this is nothing's going to Africa. All of this is going to Europe. Okay, so it's extraction at its worst. It's colonial. It's going to potentially put the investors in this project, like other investors that are putting money into carbon bombs right now. The threat that they must understand is that activism against that is rising all around the world, and the possibility of them ending up with what they like to call stranded carbon assets is becoming more and more a reality.
Just oil, the wealth of natural resources across the continent of Africa, why so many of them, and certainly the profits, are going to Europe, to China and elsewhere, but not to the continent itself?
I think we've lost each other.
Can you hear us, Kumi? Can you hear us, Kumi?
I don't hear them anymore.
We're talking to Kumi Naidoo in Johannesburg, South Africa. He may have just lost the line to us. He's the former head of Greenpeace International and also Amnesty International. And he was just thrown out of a Standard Bank meeting in South Africa protesting ECOP. Let me go to Extinction Rebellion activist Malik Dasu, who was also thrown out with Kumi, speaking outside Standard Bank's AGM.
We want them to invest in renewable energy for the mass populations, vulnerable communities, direct it where it's needed. The concept of energy justice should be the primary guiding principle that informs all their investment strategies in energy from now on.
Germany also held Stop ECOP protests in Bonn, where they gathered for a COP28 prep conference. This year's United Nations-sponsored climate summit will be hosted by one of the world's biggest fossil fuel producers, the United Arab Emirates. The meeting will be presided over by the head of UAE's national oil company, Sultan Al Jaber. On Tuesday, the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, who recently graduated from high school, spoke at the conference.
It is what we decide now that will define the rest of humanity's future. And whether we choose to do that or not, if we don't, it will be a death sentence to countless of people. And it is already a death sentence to countless of people living on the front lines of the climate crisis today.
On Tuesday, the U.S. Special Climate Envoy, John Kerry, told the U.N. Security Council global steps to tackle climate change must be ramped up, and the world needs to more aggressively reduce its reliance on coal and other fossil fuels.
It's now indisputable that the climate crisis is one of the top security threats, not just to the developed world, but to the entire planet, to life on the planet itself. And it is a crisis that already today costs countries billions of dollars each year, which we spend not even to prevent at this point, but just to clean up the mess. And most importantly, it costs the world millions of lives. It's an active threat against the livelihoods and the peace of people everywhere on this planet.
In May, over 130 U.S. lawmakers and members of the European Parliament sent a joint letter to President Biden, to the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, as well as the U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, demanding the removal of Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber, head of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, as president of the upcoming U.N. Climate Summit, COP28, in the UAE. The lawmakers include Senators Ed Markey and Bernie Sanders, who wrote, "One of the largest barriers to strong climate action has been and remains the political influence and obstruction of the fossil fuel industry and other major polluting industries." We want to thank Kumi Naidoo in Johannesburg, South Africa, the former head of Greenpeace International and Amnesty International, who just got detained along with Extinction Rebellion thrown out of a Standard Bank meeting. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Fels, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Research shows that walking through a forest for just 15 minutes can lower symptoms of anxiety and depression and boost positive moods. What better way to welcome spring than by spending time among the trees? As a national nonprofit organization, Tree Canada works to improve the lives of Canadians by planting and nurturing trees in communities across the country. They support individuals, local groups, businesses, and municipalities to increase tree cover and help fight climate change. Join Tree Canada in growing better places to live by visiting treecanada.ca.
Broadcasting on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.